Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Erica Easley Hauser, and thank you for listening to this podcast for New Books Network. Each month, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend time speaking with the author. Today, we'll be talking with historian Angela Pulley Hudson, who's the author of a fascinating book entitled Creek Paths and Federal Roads, Indians, Settlers, and Slaves, and the Making of the American South, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2010. While some historical writing styles may seem inaccessible to some readers, Angela does a wonderful job in her narrative, uncovering the complexities of race and space in the American South in the 18th and 19th centuries. She considers the historical origins and geography of Creek lands and the various paths and borders established with intersections of outsiders, namely European and African Americans. I hope that you'll enjoy our conversation. Angela?
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us today and to talk about your new book, Creek Paths and Federal Roads, Indians, Settlers, and Slaves, and the Making of the American South, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2010. And I want to thank you just for taking the time to speak with us today.
Sure.
I noticed, obviously, it's gotten a lot of attention. There's been lots of book reviews and academic journals, and so I'm really excited to talk about the book and certainly for our listeners to hear more about the book. Very exciting book. I was really happy when I found it and read it. But before we delve into getting into the book, I wanted you to just share with our readers and our listeners, rather, a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? How did you come to study Creek history? And anything else that you'd like to share with us about, just kind of how you came to this topic?
Sure, of course. Thanks very much for inviting me and for having me on. I grew up, as I say, early on in Creek Paths. I grew up all over the South. I'm originally from South Carolina, but I lived in Tennessee and Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, and so I spent a lot of my childhood traveling around the South, both, my family moving from place to place and just sort of traveling, going on road trips and that sort of thing. So in some ways, although I never envisioned that I was going to write a book about travel and roads and transportation, I guess in some ways I'm sort of uniquely suited to do it. I went to did my undergrad at Auburn University. I had my degree in English and Spanish. At that time, I wasn't really interested in history, and certainly not in American history. It's always interesting, how these things turn out. But at the time, I thought, oh, how boring. Everything's been done in American history. so I was more interested in literature, and that's what I did my degree in. And then I did a master's in English and literature at the University of Georgia. And while I was there, I started working on Native American literature and really started to get fascinated with it, but I was frustrated by the fact that I didn't know enough of the history, as it turned out, to really, make sense of a lot of the literature and the criticisms. So I started to make a pest of myself and go and knock on doors in the history department and ask lots of questions and really try to sort of educate myself about American Indian history at that time as a way of getting a better grasp on understanding some of the literature and literary criticism. When I finished my master's there, I wasn't sure that I wanted to go on to graduate school for the PhD, so I took a job at the Digital Library of Georgia, which is housed there at the University of Georgia Libraries. And they had just received a grant through IMLS, and which is a division of NEH. And I was hired to assist with this grant, essentially to be one of the project directors. And our goal was to digitize about 2,000 manuscripts, historical manuscripts related to southeastern Indian history from the founding of the colony of Georgia in 1733 up through at least through the removal period. So I got this job not because I had the technical skills to create a digital database and not really because I had the historical wherewithal to you know explain everything about southeastern Indian history, but I had done a good bit of research on the Cherokees for my master's thesis, which included a chapter on Elias Boudinot, the Cherokee newspaper editor.
Okay.
And so I think it was that and just my passion for the project and my sheer enthusiasm and unwillingness to be denied that made them hire me.
Right.
And it was over the course of 2 years working there to digitize these manuscripts that were all related to southeastern Indian history that I really both sort of, you know, got my training as a historian in terms of how to do archival research, but also it's where my interest in Creek history in particular was born. And a lot of the questions that that formed the dissertation and later the book, Creek Paths, originated in that 2 years sort of paid internship, really, at the Digital Library of Georgia.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's really a great, you know, position to kind of get a perspective of history, and now with so much, you know, being digital and being very useful for historians, which I certainly appreciate.
Yes.
yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense, especially, you know, your background in literature and the connections with history. And I think you can definitely see, you know, how those sort of interests merge with the writing of your book.
Uh-huh.
I really enjoy just your style of writing.
Thank you.
Especially when you begin your introduction, which is entitled Old Paths, New Roads, and you paint this wonderful picture, I think, for readers, just simply talking about this metaphor of roadways and how you're understanding this history and this, you know, Creek world that you're writing about. So can you just talk a little bit about, you know, how did you choose that to be sort of your metaphor for understanding this history when, you know, certainly many other historians have used, you know, the middle ground as the metaphor, you know, which is certainly, I think, widely known. But I really like your metaphor and how you kind of explained it. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, how did you come to that?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I, you know, there has been some wonderful work over the past two decades in particular in American Indian history and ethnohistory. I'm looking at space and place. You know, and we can talk about, you know, a lot of folks sort of reference the so-called spatial turn in the humanities, and of course ethnohistory is a beneficiary of that. But one of the things I was really interested in, and it emerged from my intensive study of a lot of these documents when I was doing the digital archive, but one of the things I was most interested in is how did historic Creek people define the spaces that they inhabited? Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you know, thinking about paths and pathways, it's a useful metaphor. It's a methodological tool, you know, that I use to try and bring the reader into an understanding of the interior South during this time period. Mm-hmm. But it's not merely a metaphor. One of the things that frustrated me about some of the work on space and place, not so much in American Indian history, but maybe in the humanities more broadly, was that a lot of times the metaphors that were being deployed didn't seem to me to reflect the worldviews of the people that for whom they were being deployed. So in other words, you know, one of the things I wanted to avoid as a historian was coming up with a model or an approach or a metaphor that would have been alien to the people that I was writing about, that would not have resonated with them. You know, it might have been a useful writing tool or conceptual tool for me and maybe even for readers, but wouldn't have reflected the reality of people's lives in the late 18th and early 19th century South. Right. So in the course of working in a lot of the materials, the Creek materials, I began to see repeated references to thinking about paths and pathways. And these were both references to sort of cosmology and thinking about, you know, paths like a spirit's road. But it was also, these were also political references to the pathways that held the Creek Confederacy together. For example. And so the more I began to see these references, the more I began to piece together that for the Creek Confederacy and later the Creek Nation, paths and pathways were very important, very central to their understanding of the world that they inhabited in every sense of the word. So that's how the metaphor really emerged from the research itself. And it was my effort to try and reconstruct the way in which Creek people at that time conceived of the places that they lived and how that then framed their interactions and their understanding of diplomacy with and interactions with outsiders as they begin to come into their territories.
Okay. Yeah, you also, kind of related to that, you do a nice job with even just kind of the geographic landscape and explaining that, which kind of, you know, leads me to the question of simply understanding sources and how you were able to kind of figure some of these things out. You know, was it, you know, through oral tradition, manuscript, I mean, or obviously a combination of both, or, you know, how did you kind of deal with, you know, just sort of unpacking some of this history with the sources that you were finding?
Sure. Well, a lot of the material on trying to sort of reconstruct Creek cosmology and roughly that time period came from looking at stories that had been recorded, so aspects of the oral tradition that had been recorded. And, you know, ethnohistorians struggle with how to use some of these recorded oral histories, particularly those that are dated much later than the time periods that we're studying. So I did try very hard, and particularly in working on that first chapter where I'm trying to articulate, you know, historic Creek beliefs about space, about boundaries, about travel and mobility. I did try very hard to isolate aspects of the oral tradition that date to roughly around the time that the topics that I'm addressing in the book, so that I wouldn't, you know, face charges of upstreaming, as some historians and ethnohistorians often find fault, you know, with using later oral accounts to talk about earlier historical moments. So that was one thing. It was both sort of have a strategy that I used, but, you know, also a challenge that I think all have ethnohistorians face at some point in our writing. One of the other kinds of sources that I used pretty extensively were diplomatic sources, you know, the kinds of journals and ancillary writings that go along with treaties. This is a place where Creek diplomats in particular are often trying to educate their British, French, Spanish, and later American counterparts on you know, whose territory we are actually in at a given moment, right? And trying to, you know, sort of sometimes provide a bit of a history lesson as well as a geography lesson of whose land this is and who belongs here and why. So those sources, although we typically turn to them to find out, you know, what piece of land was ceded or what was the particular agreement in this or that treaty, those sources can also be, you know, very useful in helping to reconstruct the way in which people thought about the spaces they inhabited. Then finally, one other, I mean, there are many different bodies of sources that I called on, but one other source of material that was really useful was travel writing. And that really helped me to try and imagine what it was like, what it was actually like to travel on some of these paths, to travel on some of these roads as they were expanding into the Old Southwest, you know, to try and get a feeling for what it was like to travel through this space. And those are often really fascinating works, too, so it's easy to kind of get enamored with them.
Yeah. Well, that sort of relates to, I mean, I think even broader issues, I think certainly for, you know, historical writing is trying to sort of really write this history about agency and understanding resistance, certainly for Native Americans, I mean, in your case, particularly for the Creeks. And so I'm wondering, you know, how did your sources give you clearly that evidence to be able to, you know, really tell that story in the way that you do, you know, and explaining literally this history of land and changes and outsiders coming to this land and, you know, kind of how did that kind of the sources basically inform your writing and understanding of that agency, you know, of the Creeks?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, you know, one of the things that is very challenging, I think, for many historians, but particularly those of us who study populations that did not leave an extensive written record, one of the real challenges is to isolate, to recognize, to honor those voices when they appear. And a lot of times, that requires us to do what, you know, we often call reading against the grain in documentary sources, you know, which is just sort of a fancy way of saying that, you know, we're looking at the silences and the sort of absences in a lot of these records, what doesn't get said or what seems to be implied, in order to try and recognize American Indian people in this case, but also people of African descent, as I try to talk about as well in the book, but to recognize their role in shaping this space. And so one of the things that helped me was, since I had worked to try and understand some Creek cosmological beliefs about space, about territory, boundaries, travel, mobility, I believe that helped me in analyzing some of the other documentary materials. It helped me to be able to recognize when, for example, a Creek headman from a particular town was making a reference to a very old, a very old concept in Creek thinking, and how usually he was making use of that concept in his diplomatic engagement with, you know, Americans or others. So in a lot of ways, some of those references wouldn't necessarily be recognized on the surface as moments of resistance, as you called them. But when we connect them back to this sort of genealogy of thinking about space and thinking about territory and the freedom to move through territory, then we begin to see that what might at first look like a comment about whether or not Americans have the right to travel this particular path, for example, is really about who has the right to be in this space, in the universe, right? So in some ways, unpacking some of that, some of the oral tradition about space and place and Creek thinking helped me to be able to recognize some of those moments of resistance, even when they're embedded or otherwise submerged in, you know, pretty official-looking documents, for example.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. That actually leads me to another question, actually, that kind of, I think, intersects a lot, especially, you know, when you think about, you know, your subtitle, you know, Indian settlers and slaves, and how sort of those sort of three entities, if you will, are connected sort of on these, you know, on these paths and these sort of borders, and then, of course, you know, with moments of war. And you talk a lot about, especially with the Red Stick War, which, you know, I think some listeners are probably familiar with a bit, but, you know, for those perhaps who might not be, can you just maybe explain a little bit about, you know, the significance of, you know, such sort of land and geographic borders that, you know, would precipitate warfare in this case?
Well, one of the things that that was most striking to me and got me interested in writing this book was when I was working on these documents for the digital archive, and I would find records, for example, of surveyors going into Creek country to draw boundary lines between a colony and the Creeks, or between later one of the American states and the Creeks, and I anticipated that the Creek leaders with whom these surveyors would engage or interact, I assumed that they would always be opposed to anyone coming in and surveying their lands and, you know, drawing lines and marking boundaries. And what I found was quite the opposite, which was that many times they were inviting people in to survey these lines, recognizing the utility and the importance of boundaries in order to protect their territory and later their nation, and that they weren't interested in stopping access to their land, but in controlling it. And I think the sort of loss of control around the access to the land, in other words, a loss of control about who was allowed to come into Creek space, is part of what precipitates the Creek War in 1813. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a lot of American history, if the Creek War, the Red Stick War, is mentioned, it's mentioned as a sort of an offshoot of the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. And there is some truth to that in the sense that that was part of the larger context of the war, and the Creeks were constantly rumored to be receiving aid from the British. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to think of it as a sort of self-contained event as well, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Right,
because a lot of what's going on in the Creek War is very much about a battle for which worldview is going to win out. Mm-hmm. So there are those amongst the Creeks who are very much opposed to continued making of treaties with the Americans. Mm-hmm. They are opposed to greater access for Americans in Creek territory, so more Americans traveling on roads through Creek territory, for example. And they're opposed to the kinds of concessions that they see some of their leaders making, or what they believe are concessions. And then, of course, there is, as is described in some of the wonderful works on the Creek War itself, like Joel Martin's Sacred Revolt, for example. This is, in many ways, also a contest for the right way to be Creek. I mean, it's a religious war. It's a civil war in many ways. Mm-hmm. So what I try to do in the book is to use the battles over paths and territory to establish one more context for understanding the war. Not to suggest that it's the only reason why the war erupts,
right.
But that it is an important part of the context of the war that maybe previously we haven't quite given as much importance as we should. So that's
right.
My attempt to make a contribution to the study of the Creek War.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
that's really.
But in terms of thinking about the folks who traveled into Creek territory, I mean, this is where the Indian settlers and slaves comes from. I mean, this, of course, is a sort of not so subtle homage to Daniel Ellsner's work for the Lower Mississippi Valley. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I try very hard to make clear in the book is that Creek history is not self-contained from Southern history. It's not, it's not separate from the history of slavery,
right.
For example. All of these things must be understood as part of the same story. They're taking place in the same space, and these groups of individuals are negotiating, sometimes resisting one another, but sometimes collaborating with one another. Indian settlers and slaves on what it means to live in this space, on who has the right to be here, who has the right to travel through, who has the right to stay.
Right.
And so although the book is primarily about Creeks and the Creek Nation in this time period, it was very important to me to also really try and integrate the experience of non-Indigenous settlers who come into the region, and also people of African descent, both enslaved and free, who also make their way into this space.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. You mentioned Daniel Ellsner's work, which kind of also makes me think about, how does your work fit into, some of this newer research that's come about, as you mentioned, over the last, 20 years, but then there's really kind of this interesting emergence of new works that have been coming out over the last decade, even,
mm-hmm.
That certainly, I think, connect to your work and really fit quite nicely. Can you talk a little bit about, how some of those intersections work or how you sort of see yourself as part of this body of new literature on sort of the Native South?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'm honored to be considered among those who are producing some of this amazing work, that's been coming out over the past, especially the past 10 years. And mm-hmm. And there is such a wonderful energy right now in thinking about the Native South and, what does that mean and how can we participate in, for example, Southern history? How can we participate in American Indian history? In thinking about ethnohistory. My work in many ways is trying to make a contribution to this literature by, as I suggested before, really trying to firmly integrate some topics and some issues that are often discussed separately, even still today, you know, often discussed separately. You know, so for example, there is still a tendency, I think, there is still a kind of insularity to, for example, the history of slavery. So even though we are seeing some amazing work come out, Christina Snyder's book, for example, on Indian slavery, Robbie Etheridge's work, you know, the there is still a tendency in the in thinking about the history of enslaved people of African descent in the South to treat that as a sort of separate field of study, for example. So one of the things I tried to do in my book in terms of contributing not only to Southeastern Indian history, but the history of the South, you know, is to say, well, people of African descent were forced and but also willing travelers in Creek country. So instead of thinking about this as a story of, you know, of slaves being moved in to advance the sort of march of the Cotton South, what if we think about it from the perspective of these people of African descent who are traveling through Creek space? What was it like for them? How did they make sense of it? How did the Creeks make sense of these newcomers in their lands? So, you know, in some ways, what I've tried to do is to contribute to some of this literature that talks about, for example, slavery in the context of Indian country in the South, but to do it through this lens of thinking about spatiality and thinking about territoriality and mobility. So if there's something unique in the book, I hope that's what it is.
Yeah, definitely.
But I mean, there is such a wonderful, as I say, energy in Native South work these days. Now there's still, I think, a tendency to focus on, and I'm as guilty of this as anyone, to focus on big groups. You know, so I'm talking about the Creeks, for example. And I think there is still a tendency to write about Cherokees and Creeks probably more frequently than some of the other groups, although that's changing. And so, you know, one of the other trends that's really worth paying attention to is, for example, Joshua Piker's book on Okfuski, and it really sort of taking a very micro level and saying, let's go down on the village level and try to get a better understanding of what's going on in Indian country in this time period by getting away from these large constructs of confederacies and nations and that sort of thing and getting right down on the level of human experience. I think that, and I would be delighted to see more of that kind of approach in Native South studies as we move forward.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I know we've spoken offline about you know, how some of this connects, I think, to some of your current work. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about, you know, how do your interests continue as you begin, you know, your new study that you're working on.
Well, you know, as I said at the outset of the interview, I never anticipated that I would write a book about roads and travel, but maybe, you know, parts of my life were had set me on that course long ago. So it seems like I'm continuing on that course in some ways because the book I'm working on currently is framed very much by travel on rivers. So this is, if Creek Paths was my road book, this is my river book. I've moved forward into the 19th century, so I'm traveling on steamboats with my subjects instead of, you know, on horseback or on foot on the Creek Paths. So in brief, what I'm researching now is the life of a couple. He was born Warner McCary. He was born a slave in Mississippi in Natchez in about 1810. After he's manumitted, he goes on to travel around the country, even into Canada, forms a new persona for himself, and becomes quite famous as the Choctaw flutist Okatebi. He joins up in his 30s with a woman who claims to be the daughter of a Mohawk chief. She goes by the name La Seal Manitoy and La Tubby, quite an elaborate name. It turned out to be one of many aliases. She was she was a white Mormon divorced mother of three, and not the Mohawk princess that she claimed to be. This pair crafted a really complex set of alternate personas for themselves, performing as Indians on stage and musical shows, in sort of reform context, temperance, for example. but also as patent medicine doctors, as medical providers, they had one constant in their careers, which they were professional Indians. That was their guise or disguise, no matter what their other vocation was at the time, you know, whether it was musical performer or medical doctor. So I'm essentially using their lives as an optic for understanding race, ethnicity, religion, and popular culture in the antebellum period, with you know, sort of trying to make clear that Indianness, or the idea of Indians and Indianness, was central to the U.S. And Canada in terms of thinking about race and ethnicity, and in terms of thinking about popular culture and health and wellness, that at the central, the sort of central core here, Indianness was everywhere. And of course, this is at the same time that removal is taking place, or has just taken place, removal of Eastern Indians to a territory west of the Mississippi River. So I'm trying to work all of this together, along with an amazing story that this couple left to me. I couldn't make this up if I wanted to. I'm not imaginative enough or a good enough fiction writer to ever be able to come up with a story more outrageous and fascinating than their lives.
Oh, wow. No, it sounds fascinating, and I'm definitely looking forward to seeing, you know, how you, you know, contribute and build upon, you know, Daniel Littlefield, and, you know, we've spoken about this, and I think it'll be a really, really interesting work to read, so I definitely can't wait to hear when it will be published.
Well, thank you.
Well, I do want to thank you for, again, taking time to speak with me today, and I certainly want to encourage all of our listeners to check out your first monograph, Creek Paths and Federal Roads, Indians, Settlers, and Slaves, and the Making of the American South. Again, thank you very much for your time, and I'll certainly be following up with you soon.
All right. Thanks, Erica. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
You've been listening to the interview podcast featuring Angela Pulley Hudson, author of Creek Paths and Federal Roads, Indians, Settlers, and Slaves, and the Making of the American South, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2010. For more information, you can find us on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com or on Facebook to post comments or questions about books or themes that you'd like to hear discussed. I'm Erica Easley-Hauser, and thank you again for joining us at New Books in Native American Studies.